Well, I guess they're staying. Your old man sure surprised me.
You're not the only one.
The only thing Jason could figure out was that his father was, in some way, using Rome and Abigail to put the Reverend Milcher in his place. If so, it had worked as far as he could tell. Milcher sure had his drawers in a bunch, which was just as fine with Jason, if the truth be told. He couldn't abide the man, but then he didn't like much of anybody on the train. There was an open, ongoing aggravation between him and Matt McDonald. It was only a matter of time before it would come to blows, and everybody knew it. He found Mr. Nordstrom haughty and stuck up, the Mortons, every single one of them, including Milton Griggs, too boring for words, and Eulalie Jameson, and all three of her grown kids, too bigoted and narrow-minded to live. And the rest of them, he didn't know well enough to dislike. He figured he would in time, though. But he thought he kind of liked Ward Wanamaker, and he knew he'd like the oldest Milcher boy, Tommy, probably because he was a frequent target of Matt McDonald, and he was certain that he liked Megan McDonald. The girl was pretty, with long, shiny, set-of-red braids, sparkling green eyes fringed with russet lashes, and a fair, freckled face. And she made him laugh. She was only 17, though, and so he hadn't made any overtures. Only 17, and bound to stay with her family out west once they got there. He'd be headed back east, to college, which was no place for a married man. Ward had been saying something or other, and Jason had completely lost track of it.
What?
Where were you? Rhode Island? Indians? I asked if we should count on a fight anytime soon.
Hard to tell. Before the war, we could buy most of them off with cattle or trade goods. That's been years ago, though.
So you know about as much about it as I do.
I'd say you nailed it, Ward.
Saul and Rachel Cohen lay snug in their quilts, having tucked their three boys into the spare wagon and seen them safely asleep. Saul was pleased about the evening's goings-on, although he was sorry the subject had come up. Again.
Will it ever stop, Saul?
You expect it to stop? How can it stop? All these goyim are still so ignorant. Since the beginning of time, they've been ignorant. You think anything will change that?
I suppose you are right. But still, I will pray for them.
Now you're sounding like Reverend Milcher, Rachel. Always praying for people. Who don't want to be prayed for, I might add.
Possibly, Saul. But I have a more direct route. No middleman.
3 weeks, one broken leg, a busted collarbone, and one Paiute episode later, the wagons found themselves cutting down into Indian territory. Electa Morton had tripped in a gopher hole and broken her leg below the knee and was now teaching school from the back of her parents' wagon. Young Tommy Milcher, Jason's friend and admirer, fell from his horse and broke his collarbone. As for the Paiute, they had been a small band of stragglers and had been bought off with the offer of three of Jedediah's eating steers from the herd, two blankets, and one hand mirror with Jedediah's box of trinkets. They'd ridden off, happy as larks. But Jason was concerned. The wagons would be going through Comanche territory, and nobody but him seemed the least bit upset about this. Even his father, usually a most careful guardian, seemed unconcerned. Maybe Jedediah knew something he didn't. He sincerely hoped that was the case. They were 2 days into Indian territory, and their surroundings had gradually changed from the endless grasslands of Kansas, where they had gathered buffalo chips for fuel to burn and bumped across seas of buffalo bones, to a rugged kind of half-desert, half-plains. The kids were more often riding than walking, even more than his father had decreed the night he had the blow-up with Milcher. But Milcher had been halfway quiet ever since, with the exception of Sunday mornings. Roman and Abigail had been left alone, and the Cohens had been unmolested, insofar as he knew, by either hand or word. Hamish McDonald, however, was becoming more and more of a problem. He had his own map, and it was his dogged persistence that had taken them this particular route. Jedediah had wanted to stay either further north or cut down further south, mostly to avoid the Comanche threat. But Hamish swore up and down that he had it on good authority from his brother-in-law, who had settled in Houston some years ago, that lately the whole Indian problem was much exaggerated and mostly a fabrication of the Eastern newspapers. Jason was surprised his father hadn't fought harder against Hamish. But he hadn't, and for the first time, Jason wondered if perhaps his father was getting too old for these trips. Jason was out riding with the herd, and they were slowly moving over a hill of red earth about 200 yards north of the wagons. Grazing had been good for the livestock so far, and they were all fat and sleek. He knew that wouldn't last long, though. The grazing was growing sparse and would continue to grow thinner and thinner. He swung farther to the north to bring in a stray calf when he caught a movement from the corner of his eye. It wasn't much, just a patch of color that shouldn't have been there, and he could no longer see it. But he'd been well trained by his father, and he immediately called to Ward.
Get the herd down the hill!
And then he bolted down himself toward the train, chasing the errant calf before him. He came down so fast that his mare nearly skidded into the side of the McDonald's wagon.
Circle the wagons in tight! Men, get your firearms ready!
Percy! Cover that side!
Over here!
Hurry, hurry! Circle the wagons in tight! Men, get your guns out! Circle the wagons!
He cantered down the line as they all sped up and made a halfway decent circle up ahead.
Quick! Get those cattle and horses down here!
He heard his father shouting instructions too, while the herd of horses and cattle and such climbed down the hill and headed for the circle. The men left a gap between two wagons just wide enough to funnel the herd through, three and four at a time, then closed it tight as Jason galloped back. It was just in time, too. He saw the attacking Indians breasting the hill's crest just as he jumped his palomino over the traces of Rome Lefebvre's silly little buggy. Leaping from the saddle and slapping his palomino on the backside, Jason crouched down beside Rome. His pistol was in one hand and his rifle was in the other. All Rome had in his shaking hands was an old Colt Navy and a Derringer. Abigail was crouched beside him, white with terror. Jason saw their attackers now, and too clearly. They came boiling down the hillside in full battle regalia, with very serious looks on their painted faces. He rolled up his rifle and drew a bead on one of the front riders, and missed. This time, his slug hit home. By now, the suddenly formed camp was in a panic. Some of the men were doing as Jedediah had instructed back in Missouri, firing while their wives or kids reloaded. Others, including Roman, were simply frozen.
Shoot, you idiot! You know what a Comanche will do to you if they get in here? They'll tie you to a wagon wheel, cut a hole in your belly, string your guts out while you watch, and let the pigs eat them while you're still living.
Abigail fainted. Rome went to work with his gun. Jason just kept on firing. He fired, in fact, until he ran himself out of ammunition and had to make a run across the circle to the ordnance wagon. On his way, he dodged confused cattle and spooked horses, jumped over a dog, snatched up a wandering milcher kid, and took a stray arrow just above his left elbow. He handed over the milcher's spawn, then reached across his body and broke the arrow off. It was bleeding like a butchered hog, but he didn't have time for it now. His father was at the ordnance wagon and tossed him down a box of the right ammo for his rifle. His eye flicked to Jason's arm.
It's all right, Pa. Watch yourself.
And then he headed back across. He ducked down behind Salmon Kendall's rig. Salmon needed some help. His wife, Cordelia, lay behind him, struck by a Comanche lance. Dead. His daughter, Peony, lay across her mother, sobbing. Salmon and his boy, Sammy Jr., both had rifles and were firing with a grim purpose. Sammy Jr.'s face was streaked with tears, but his expression was resolute. Salmon just looked like he was in shock. Load, fire, load, fire, load, fire. But he was accurate. Before him lay four dead Comanche, one of whom had made it halfway past the wagon's wiffle bar. It was likely the Indian's lance that had killed Cordelia, Jason thought. Quickly, he knelt beside Salmon, shouldered his rifle, and took a shot at the swiftly circling Indians.
Should've got yourself a repeater!
No money!
Another Comanche dropped from his pony.
Your kid isn't hitting anything! Have him load for you instead!
Sammy!
Across the circle, Jedediah had located Milt Billings, the only man of them who spoke any of the Comanche's lingo. Milt was emptying his handgun into the swarm at the time, so Jedediah waited until they stopped to reload.
Milt! Milt! Can you talk to these Indians? Tell them we'll give them cattle!
But Milt, concentrating on loading his gun, simply shook his head.
No way these boys are gonna settle for anything but the whole herd. Goats, pigs, and all. And the girls.
Jedediah's blood ran momentarily cold. He'd known what the Comanche were after. Hadn't wanted to admit it to himself. Hadn't wanted to believe their luck could be that bad. Why had he let Milcher and McDonald talk him into this bloody route anyway? If they got out of this, he was going to ride into Houston, Texas himself and take a good hard kick at Hamish McDonald's brother-in-law's backside. Maybe his head. And then he felt a sharp pain in his side.
What?
He tumbled backward. Suddenly, he couldn't see very well, which was strange because he'd always had eyes like an eagle. Maybe it was later in the day than he thought. Maybe it was getting dark. That was good, wasn't it? The Comanche would break off their attack come nightfall.
Mr. Fury! Somebody get Dr. Morelli! Dear God, Fury's down!
And then, he heard no more. Jason was over by Carrie English's wagon, helping Carrie and her daughter put some sort of system in place when Morelli came for him. He had just about decided to send Gil Collins, one of the hired men, down to help her. She was a widow, and she was a lousy shot. Someone put a hand on his shoulder and he wheeled.
No!
Morelli quickly blocked the rifle's barrel with his forearm.
Come with me, Jason, now!
Sorry, Widow English, I'll send you some help.
Morelli said no more, just shoved his way through the milling, excited herd, leading a puzzled Jason. If there was something wrong, why hadn't his father taken care of it? He stopped following Morelli when he spotted Gil Collins, who was helping the McDonalds, who probably needed the least help of anybody. Both Hamish and Matthew were firing, taking down their share of the Redskins, with Megan reloading like a maniac.
Gil! Hey, Gil! Go help out the Widow English! Take Megan along with you!
Quickly, he caught sight of Morelli, who had paused and was waving at him frantically. Jason pushed forward again, leaping over dead and dying livestock, shoving the living ones out of his way. He fervently hoped they weren't losing as many people. When he caught up with Morelli, he was standing over a prone, blanketed figure, and the bottom dropped out of Jason's stomach. The toe of his father's boot protruded from one end.
It's numb.
I'm afraid so, son. Your father took a lance through the lungs. There's nothing I can do.
Jason barely had time to absorb this when a great roar and cry arose from the east side of the circled wagons. Jason saw that the circle had been breached beside the gambler's rig, and that there were Comanche inside their camp, driving out livestock and taking captives. Women and young girls were snatched up into the arms of mounted heathen, as men and boys alike tried their best to hold back the seemingly endless horde. A tomahawk swung, and young Tommy Milcher, the boy that Jason had saved from a beating by Matt McDonald back in Kansas City, fell dead, his head nearly separated from his body.
Ha! No!
A lance split the air and fatally pinned Miranda Nordstrom to the side of a wagon. Her husband, Randall, ran to her, putting a slug squarely through the neck of the brave that had killed her. By the time Jason, Dr. Morelli, Hamish McDonald, and Saul Cohen hastily worked their way through the terrified livestock, the Comanche were already riding off and had cut off their attack. They had a small herd of horses and cattle and a small number of the older girls that had been at the end of a circle.
Goat
three of my goddamn Morgans!
I think you'd be more concerned about your daughter, Hamish.
Jason began searching for Jenny. His sister had been wearing a yellow dress, he remembered. Where in that milling mob of confused and heartbroken settlers could he glimpse even a flash of that color? Hamish set in to search, too.
Megan! Megan, girl! Answer your father!
Jason could find that yellow color nowhere in the camp. But as the Indians breasted a distant hill, he saw it. She was slung across an Indian pony, and as far as he could tell, she was still fighting her captor. Good girl. Good Jenny. She was a fury, after all, and it was up to him to save her. Jason had barely given Morelli time to get the arrow out and patch up his arm before he was in the saddle. The weeping of women was all around him, and the silent tears of the men he felt more than he heard. Lord knows it was all he could do to keep his own tears back. He had lost his father and his sister, all that remained of his entire family. But he wasn't alone, he kept reminding himself. Nearly everyone had lost someone, man, woman, or child, either to the lance, or the arrow, or the blade, or to the kidnapping. Milt Billings, the man who spoke Comanche, came along, as did Ward Wanamaker. They had to go along, because they worked for the Furies, which meant they now worked for Jason. And oddly enough, Saul Cohen tagged along. Jason couldn't figure what Cohen was trying to prove, but he wasn't about to turn down any volunteer. Except Matt McDonald. Jason didn't want to ride with anybody who'd screw it up, which was something Matt was bound to do. Instead, he told Matt and Hamish that he needed them both at the wagons. They were both good shots, and the Comanche could well come back. But Jason knew there wasn't a chance in hell those Indians would return. They'd gotten what they wanted. He gave orders that the dead be buried, the injured be taken to Dr. Morelli's wagon, which was serving as their hospital, and that the dying livestock be put down as painlessly as possible. He also gave orders that somebody get the dead steers dressed out and start them to roasting. He didn't want anything to be wasted. They'd need that meat. Through the twilight, Jason and his group rode over the same hills the Comanches had traveled with their prisoners. Through the night, under the moon and the stars, they followed the savages' trail. And then, finally, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, they were just breasting a rise.
Down! Everybody get down!
He had spotted the camp. Ward took the horses back down the rise and out of sight, while the other three men lay on their bellies, scouting the camp with binoculars or spyglasses. Down below, all was quiet. Only a couple of small fires were still burning themselves out. There were a few teepees set up, but it didn't look to Jason like any sort of permanent camp. Probably just a raiding party.
There's our stock.
Saul pointed quickly to the northeast. Sure enough, their cattle and horses, along with the Comanche ponies, stood quietly, dozing within a crude corral their captors had tied together from the plentiful tumbleweeds. It was staked, at intervals, by lances thrust down through the thickest part of the sage.
Shit, this is gonna be easy.
Easy? Just how is that?
We just sneak down and drive off all the livestock.
And what about the girls?
Oh, I forgot about them.
You've got too much of your mind on McDonald's Morgans, Milt. You best be thinking about his daughter instead.
So, is anyone hatching anything close to a plan? I'm thinking that maybe we should just ask them nice, but then again, I'm thinking that's probably the best way to get them mad again.
Don't take much.
No, maybe Milt didn't have such a bad idea, Jason. I mean, Mr. Fury.
It's still Jason. And you mean we should use that as a diversion?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing myself.
It could work, or not.
Guess I ain't so stupid after all.
The four of them backed down the slope. 20 minutes later found them creeping along the outside fringes of the camp. Jason was in the lead, and he had just reached the makeshift corral. He pulled the knife from his boot and cut the first thin strip of buffalo hide that held the brush together. Jason wheeled to see Ward Wanamaker down on the ground fighting off a Comanche warrior. He ran back toward Ward, knife in his hand. He hit the ground rolling and brought the point of his knife up just in time. The young brave who had bowled him over stopped his attack quite suddenly and stood there, a rifle in his hand and just out of reach, smiling. Jason didn't think that smile of his was any too wholesome. Neither was the rifle, come to think of it. He heard Saul Cohen being taken down from behind. Not permanently, he prayed. He could see Ward and Milt. Ward was on the ground. Milt was kneeling, head down. A Comanche blade was at his throat. Jason turned to the young Comanche standing guard over him.
Speak any English? You savvy American? Milt!
Una Taibo Tequayu?
Naniatsa.
Fury.
Jason's guard lowered the muzzle of his rifle. Just a touch.
You are Fury?
Jason Fury.
A relation to the Fury called Jedediah?
My father.
I am son of Peyton Okona, chief of the Quahada Comanche. My father knows your father and is friend to him.
Then you must be the one called Quanah Parker. My father spoke of you and your father. He traded with you often.
Why did he not come?
He's dead. Your raiding party killed him.
Stand up, Jason Fury. You are in no danger. Yet.
Once Jason got to his feet, he saw that although tall and imposing in physique, the boy was about 16 or 17 years old, and had light eyes. His father had mentioned those disconcerting eyes more than once. They were a steely gray, a legacy from his white mother, Cynthia Ann Parker, Jason thought it was. She'd been a captive, too, just like their girls. Jason started to sheathe his blade back in his boot, but Quanah shook his head.
Well, drop it to the ground. Your guns, too. Unhaku ganaha.
The other Comanches motioned their captives up, too, and divested them of their weapons.
Why have you come here tonight, Jason Fury? Why have you come to steal our horses and cattle? You come to revenge your father, maybe?
I came to retrieve what was stolen from me. I've come for my cattle and my horses and my sister. My father's life cannot be taken back.
All these are yours? Will you play for them, Jason Fury?
Play what?
I have learned a new game from our friends in Mexico.
Jason's mind was suddenly flooded with what might define a game for Quanah, and his blood nearly froze in his veins. His father had told him plenty of stories about the Comanches' penchant for cruelty as sport, even cruelty to their own dogs and horses. He shuddered, but he followed Quanah inside a tent anyway. Quanah motioned for him to sit down on the buffalo hide rug that made up the floor, and it was only once he sat that he noticed Saul, Milt, and Ward come into the tent behind him. They squatted down next to him in a line to his right. Poor Ward looked like Jason felt, terrified. Milt looked resigned, as if he'd already given in to destiny and just wanted to get it over with. Saul, on the other hand, seemed fascinated with everything he saw, from the feathered headdress hanging back against one curve of the teepee's side, and the scalp locks depending from Quanah spears, to the tent itself. He seemed to be making mental notes on its construction. The warriors who had been guarding them followed them inside, making for a cramped tent, and sat down behind them, still holding their guns on them. Not the most auspicious setting for a parlor game, Jason thought. Quanah threw some sticks on the little fire that had been dying in the center of the tent on a broad stone hearth of sorts.
Sumuki Katu.
All of a sudden, Milt smiled a little. The braves behind them lowered the weapons they held and seemed to relax. Well, Jason thought, at least it wasn't going to be a blood sport. The man behind him would have allowed himself a big belly laugh for that.
You play the game called craps? Blanket dice? Do you know it?
I've played once or twice.
Good. I find it most amusing. Satu Unse.
I'll be a badger's butt. He's sent him to wake the others, in case anybody wants to make side bets.
You have dice?
You could be holding your horses for a minute.
Jason looked down the line. Ward shrugged. Milt shook his head. Saul rooted in his pockets.
Saul?
No, I have no dice, but maybe I have something almost as good.
And with that, he produced 3 sugar cubes from his pocket.
These will do, no?
There ain't no dots on them.
There can be.
Saul inspected the cubes and discarded the one with the most wear on the edges. He held the remaining two out to Ward.
You'll hold, please, lightly, so they shouldn't melt.
Ward reluctantly took the cubes, and Saul went back to padding his pockets. This time, the ones in his vest. He finally came up with a few toothpicks and smiled. He took the sugar back from Ward and proceeded to go to work, drilling shallow, precise holes in the cubes with the end of a toothpick, then gathering a tiny bit of ash from the edge of the fire and inserting some in each hole. Not much, just enough to darken it. When he was finished with the first, Jason held out his hand.
Can I see it? Saul, this is a work of art.
Saul, working intently on the second cube, simply shrugged.
My Uncle Amos, he was a jeweler.
By that time, there was quite a crowd gathered outside the tent's flap. Someone had brought the girls, too. They were shoved into the tent behind Jason and his three companions. Jenny, true to the Fury family temperament, looked mad as hell. But that didn't stop her from giving him a quick hug.
I knew you'd come. Where's Papa?
Later, Jenny.
Jason chanced a glance at Megan. She looked confused and a little teary, but not beaten. Good girl, he thought. The third captive was Deborah Jameson, youngest daughter to the widowed Eulalie Jameson, and Deborah was the next thing to hysterical.
These three are my first wager. What do you have to match it?
All our firearms.
You forgot, Jason Fury. We have already taken your firearms.
Jason acknowledged that with a brief nod. He didn't have a single thing on him worth trading. He looked at the men. Even Saul, who he was beginning to count on to get him out of rough patches, held his hands to the side, palms up. Nothing. And then he had something akin to a stroke of genius.
We rode here on four horses, and one of them is a Palomino mare. Only 4 years old, top stock. Will they do?
He's good enough. I would like to see this mare.
Not unless you win them.
You are smart, like your father. You roll first.
They're not ivory, you know. Don't toss them too hard.
Jason took the homemade dice and shook them gently in his cupped hands. Then he closed his eyes and tossed them down in front of him. He heard a shout go up outside before he was able to pry his eyelids open. Quanah sat, shaking his head slowly, while Saul and the others grinned from ear to ear, and Jenny suddenly hugged him from behind. One die read 6, the other 5.
Jenny, is there anyone else?
No, just us three. Jason, you're wonderful, even if you're my brother.
And now I shoot. This time, it is the stolen horses against your women.
Cattle and horses against our horses. Just our horses.
No, the women too.
I guess we're done then.
Jason started to get to his feet, but the point of a spear against his shoulder sat him back down again. He didn't know who was holding it, but it didn't matter.
This time, I roll.
Jason prayed silently for a 2, 3, or 12. You lost automatically if you rolled one of those. The dice stopped rolling on the buffalo hide. A 4 and a 2. 6.
Satan knew!
He said, point is 6, or something like that.
Quanah gently shook the sugar cubes again.
7, 7.
Quiet!
The spear point that had been pressing against Jason's shoulder suddenly arced overhead and landed next to Saul's throat. Quanah threw the dice again. 10.
Psych or no?
Finally, Quanah rolled the dice again. 8. This went on for some time, with Quanah trying to roll his point of another 6 and failing each time, while Jason and his men all silently prayed he'd roll a 7. After rolling his third 10, Quanah threw the dice down and leapt to his feet.
Oh, these are loaded! You tried to cheat me!
Jason, to whom he'd made the accusation, forgot about the brave with the spear and jumped to his feet, too. Once he was standing, though, he felt its tip press hard into his back.
Ritanu!
but one shouted angry word from Quanah, and it pulled away. From the corner of his eye, Jason saw the spear holder back out of the tent.
Back with the women!
The men rose and began to back up.
All except you.
You think I loaded sugar cubes? How the heck could I do that? They weren't mine, and playing craps was your cockamamie idea in the first place.
From across the tent's tiny fire, Quanah launched himself at Jason. Quanah's hands were around Jason's throat, throttling him, and Jason did the only thing he could think of. He brought up one knee, hard, between Quanah's legs. The pressure of Quanah's fingers immediately left Jason's throat. Jason pulled Quanah back down by his beaded neckpiece, rolling atop him at the same time. Then he hauled off and punched him in the face just as hard as he could.
Jason, don't!
When Jason came in with the third punch, Quanah blocked it with a forearm, which then drove upward to clip Jason under the chin. Shaking his head, Jason looked up and saw Quanah standing over him with a peculiar look on his face, as though he was going to attack again or burst out laughing. Jason did the only thing he could think of. He smiled up at Quanah.
Your point was a six, Quanah?
You are right, Jason Fury. It was a six.
Quanah held a hand down to Jason, who gratefully took it. After Jason was back on his feet, they dusted themselves off. Jason couldn't help himself from joining in, although in his case, it was the sheer ridiculousness of the thing. Why Quanah was laughing was anybody's guess. Maybe he was thinking of all the good, clean fun his boys would have later on, torturing them. But instead of throwing Jason on the fire, he resumed his former position. Jason and his people did the same.
Jason, are you hurt?
Are you all right?
I'm fine.
After a few moments, Quanah found the dice again and inspected them for serious damage. Fortunately, they were the only things in the teepee that had escaped it. He threw them again, and ate. He frowned, then gathered them again. Jason noticed that all this tossing and the friction with hands and the buffalo hide had worn the sharp edges of the sugar cubes away. There weren't many more rolls left in them. Quanah threw the dice. Jason held his breath.
Seven!
Seven it is.
Jason couldn't believe his luck. Now, of course, he had to be even luckier to get everybody, along with the livestock, out of the village and home safely. It wasn't difficult at all, though. Quanah was a man of his word. They gathered the horses and cattle, including Saul's bullock, which his kids had named Mr. Cow, and which Saul greeted with a happy hug, and McDonald's Morgan's, and Jason left three of their meat steers behind. In the end, they had about 15 horses and cattle to drive back to camp. They rode out of the Comanche enclave fully armed and with no problem, gathered up the horses they'd ridden in on, and started back to the camp. It was coming dawn by then, and Jason was discovering new bumps and bruises every minute. The girls were asleep on their horses by the time they came in sight of the circled wagons, but the drifting scent of roasting beef brought Megan around first.
Food?
Likely more of it than you'll ever want to see again.
Jason saw kids and women turning four steers on long spits over roasting fires in the center of camp, and men hitching a team to a dead horse, presumably to drag the corpse out of the camp where they'd already dragged three others. Dr. Morelli was still hard at work. He looked to be setting one of the Milcher's kids' legs. Jason also saw Reverend Milcher out south of the wagons, presiding over the burials of the butchered whites. Milcher was good for something, anyway. In the privacy of their wagon, Jason held Jenny tightly against his chest. She wept as if her heart was broken, which it most probably was.
Hush, hush. Shh, 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 baby girl.
But why? Why didn't you tell me?
Because I thought it was best, honey.
Jenny, you've got to be brave. We've all got to be.
Why? Papa's dead, Jason. Papa's dead!
Megan McDonald, red-eyed and looking overly hugged and squeezed after her reunion with her father and brother, poked her head over the tailgate's edge.
Excuse me, Jason, but you should come.
What is it, Megan?
She climbed up into the wagon and made her way to him and Jenny.
Go see Dr. Morelli, now.
Once she'd given Jason time to get well clear of the Conestoga, Megan held Jenny away at arm's length.
Jenny, listen to me.
Ow! Why did you do that? How can you be so mean to me?
Jenny, you're not the only one. We all lost someone, be it friends or family. And Jason, who was in here comforting you, well, he lost his daddy when you did. Did you stop to think of that? Did you stop to think that he might miss him even more than you do? That the weight of being in charge and the responsibility of all of us is on his shoulders now? I don't mean to scold, Jenny. I just think you should look at things from, well, a broader perspective, that's all.
If I'd stayed in Kansas City like Papa wanted, I wouldn't know about this. I wouldn't have had to know until Jason came home.
Jenny's voice was getting a little too floaty and far away, just like Mrs. Halliday back home right before she went crazy and took an axe handle to the family cat.
Don't you go getting axe handle crazy on me, Jenny.
Huh?
I need you to get your grieving over with. Jason needs you to be done with it, or at least put it aside for a while and come help us clean up after those blasted Comanche. The horses and cattle kicked everything to pieces last night, and the Comanches will be riding in here in a couple of hours to pick up their dead. Jason's gonna need all the help he can get.
But I'm so tired.
Me too. I'm gonna leave you alone now, all right?
Yes. Thank you, Meg.
You're welcome, honey.
Megan brushed a kiss over Jenny's forehead before she climbed over the seat and back down to earth. She heard Jenny's renewed weeping from inside the wagon, but at least it was more controlled, less wild than it had been before. It was true that Megan had lost friends in the raid, but no family, thank the Lord. But then it was also true that Mr. Fury had been like a kind and good father to them all. She looked across the circle to see Jason, Dr. Morelli, and the Reverend Milcher engaged in discussion, and set out at a brisk clip to join them, or at least get within eavesdropping distance. This ought to be a scrap worth hearing.
You know, Milcher, I've been trying to be nice to you on account of your losing Tommy and your two younger boys getting hurt, but I'm just about ready to haul off and slug you.
Whatever for, sir?
You know damn well what for. You are not going to pile up those dead Comanches like so much kindling and set fire to them.
They're heathen. Murdering, thieving heathen at that. It's all they deserve.
Now, Reverend, Jason said that the other Comanche were coming to pick up their bodies. We can't have them find a pile of ashes, can we? Why, there's likely to be another massacre.
We're all shook out of shape, Milcher. We don't want to do anything that we'll be sorry for later. Quanah showed himself to be a fair man last night, and
A fair man? Since when are any godless redskins fair men? Since when do those who murder and steal qualify as men at all? They killed my son. Do you hear me, my son? The one who did it could be right out there.
When you find the one who did it, you want to carve him up a little? Maybe take his scalp? Maybe hack off his balls?
Now, Jason.
Go back to your wagon, Milcher, and think about turning the other cheek. Either grab some of that beef that's roasting, or comfort your wife. She lost Tommy too, you know. Or get some shut-eye. But when those Comanches show up to gather their dead, I do not want to see your face.
When Milcher climbed back up into his wagon, he immediately embraced his grief-stricken wife. He looked about him as his children, who were mostly whole, other than the 9-year-old boy with a broken arm and the 7-year-old boy with a bandaged calf where a heathen arrow had found home, and a 15-year-old boy who would never be with them again, never see the distant shores of California, never again join him in prayer.
Oh, God! Oh, God!
And the Reverend Milcher collapsed into tears, muttering into his wife's shoulder. Alone, his hat in his hand and the noonday sun beating on the back of his neck, Jason slowly walked down the line of fresh graves. Someone had made crosses and simply written the names of the deceased. No niceties like dates of birth or death, no beloved son or devoted wife, just last name, first initial. Here lay, now and forever, T. Milcher, plucky young Tommy, M. Nordstrom, quiet, plain-faced Miranda, who sewed like an angel, C. Kendall, Cordelia, wife of Salmon, and mother to Sammy and Peony, R. Lefebvre, Rome, the down-on-his-luck gambler, S. Wheeler, Seth, part-time blacksmith and wheelwright who had dreamt of opening his own saloon, M. Griggs, who had died from his wounds while Jason was playing dice with Quanah Parker, and, at the end of the row, his father. J. Fury, the marker said. Except, in Jedediah's case, someone had taken the time and care to carefully write Wagon Master and Good Shepherd underneath in tiny, precise letters. Obviously, someone who also had not thought highly of Hamish McDonald's all-knowing brother in Houston. Or maybe it was his brother-in-law. At this point, Jason didn't much care. All he knew for certain was that he was left with what was at least as many injured as killed. Wagons with nobody to drive them, although he figured to leave Abigail Crimp's buggy behind and have her drive the Nordstrom's second wagon. A picture flashed through his head, that of poor, plain Miranda, pinned to the side of a wagon by a Comanche spear, the life draining from her face. He shook his head like a retriever fresh from a pond, as if he could shake that picture, all the bad pictures, from his head. He couldn't, though. He knew he'd live with them for the rest of his life.
I suppose I should thank you, Fury, for getting my sister back safe.
When Jason looked over, there was a smug smirk on Matt McDonald's face.
Consider it said.
Pa sent me to get you. We're having a meeting about who should take over now that your pa's dead.
Take over? My Aunt Fanny.
That big bag of wind Hamish McDonald was behind this. He was certain of it. Jason was right. When he hopped over the wiffle tree of Salmon Kendall's wagon to enter the clearing inside the circle, there was Hamish, standing on a box, which he most likely carried around with him just to orate from, sweeping his arms back and forth. Quite a crowd had gathered around him, too.
He led us into the veritable mouth of disaster. Now, don't we need someone trustworthy? Don't we need someone seasoned? Don't we need...
somebody who knows the way?
And somebody who don't have a know-it-all brother-in-law down Texas way.
It was Zachary Morton, their eldest member and head of the Morton clan. His brother's son-in-law had been injured in the fight, and at this moment lay in his wagon, suffering from a stab wound to the chest. Morton's wife, Susanna, slapped his arm lightly, but she broke out in a grin anyway. At least, she covered her mouth with her hand to keep from showing her picket-fence teeth. But her eyes sparkled like a leprechaun's.
Jason Fury, you're only a boy!
Boy, maybe. A fool? No. Everybody, I'd like your attention, if you please. In case you haven't heard, I gave the Comanches leave to come pick up their dead this afternoon, and I reckon it won't be long before they're here. Men, I want you to keep your firearms close at hand, but I don't want anybody flashing them at the Comanches. I want this to go quick and peaceable.
The Comanches arrived within the hour, and so silently that no one was aware of their presence, until Milt Billings trotted over to Jason, who was helping Abigail Crimp move her few belongings to Randall Nordstrom's extra wagon.
They're here.
Jason looked up to see about 14 or 15 braves outside the circle, lifting the bodies of their fallen comrades onto the backs of the extra ponies they'd brought along. Several of the Indian ponies were still aimlessly wandering the scene from last night, and the braves rounded them up too and put them into service. Quanah Parker was with them, which Jason hadn't expected. This was a job you sent your minions to care of, not one on which you went yourself. But he was there, just the same, mounted on a medicine hat pinto, overseeing the others. He caught Jason's eye and lifted a hand in greeting. Jason reluctantly waved back. He could tell his men were getting antsy. Even a few of the women looked like they were ready, willing, and able to take on one of those braves with nothing but a couple of darning needles and a frying pan. Then Jason saw Matt McDonald slowly pick up his rifle and, from the cover of a wagon, draw a bead on Quanah. He stole up behind him and banged him over the head with the butt of his pistol. Matt crumpled to the ground like a bag of brass doorknobs, which got Hamish all bent out of shape.
Hey, you! Where do you get off hitting my boy like...
Jason turned his gun on Hamish.
Shut up, you.
Fortunately, Hamish was shocked enough to do it. The Indians slowly began to make their exit, leading their dead and wounded behind them, but Quanah rode closer to the circled wagons. Right up to Jason, in fact.
Greetings, Jason Fury.
Greetings, Quanah Parker.
My braves say your doctor treated the few who still lived after the battle.
Our Dr. Morelli is a good man.
You will give him my thanks, Jason Fury. Until we meet again.
Which I hope is the 12th of never.
One.
When what?
One to that low sawbones. Sneak out to help those filthy redskins.
Hamish, I haven't slept since yesterday morning. I'm tired and I'm cranky, and if you don't shut the hell up and stop causing trouble, I'm going to pull this trigger and damn the consequences. Do we understand each other? Now, if you want to do something useful, you'll put a party of men together and gather enough kerosene and brush to pile over those dead horses.
Brush?
Yeah, brush. Then set fire to them. No sense in drawing in any more predators than we have to. We're not leaving until tomorrow morning.
Dr. Morelli was leaning against a wagon wheel, dozing, when Jason walked up.
Morelli?
Jason, how goes it?
Not too good. Can you take another look at my arm before I go to my wagon and catch some sleep?
It's worse? What in the world did you do to it anyway? Here, take your shirt off.
Morelli took a look at the wound and frowned.
Been scrambling around in the dirt?
Exactly that, plus a few other things.
Why in heaven's name were...
Don't ask.
Morelli went to work. At last, after he'd removed the bandages and cleaned the wound with water as best he could, he picked up a bottle of alcohol.
This is gonna sting like hell.
He watched Jason nearly ram his fist through his own forehead when he splashed some on the open wound.
Here you help the wounded Comanche.
Yes, I took an oath to help all those who need my services.
That was real kind of you, Morelli. And also real stupid. You've got Hamish McDonald against you now. And more than likely, whoever else he's told.
I know. I've already had words with Mr. McDonald.
Yeah, erase him from your mind, Morelli. I'm in charge, and I say thank you. You did the right thing.
Morelli couldn't help smiling. He tied off the new bandage and quickly fitted Jason with a sling.
Not necessary. Now get some sleep, son. And throw out that bloody filthy shirt.
Saul Cohen, who'd slept through the entire day, woke quite pleasantly at 10 that evening to find Rachel having a plate of beef, peas, and potato pancakes under his nose.
My beauty.
You're meaning me or the food?
I can't mean both.
He kissed her before he took the plate from her hands. The boys, all three of them, were curled like dozing puppies at his feet. Rachel was with him. No one was hurt. Mr. Cow was tied to the wagon's tailgate, and the camp was quiet. The past day and a half seemed like some horrible nightmare. He hoped he'd never have it again. Saul and Rachel repaired to the driver's bench while he ate his meal, and afterward, they stayed for a while and just stared up at the moon, drinking some of the sweet wine she'd brought along. They held hands.
Was it horrible, Saul? Getting the girls and the horses and cattle back, I mean, when you had to go into the Comanche camp?
Yes and no.
Why so?
Yes, because, my darling, I was so frightened that I almost soiled myself.
I think I can understand. And why no?
He reached into his pocket and produced two much-used sugar cubes.
Sugar? Oh, throw those things away, Saul. They are full of dirt specks from your pocket.
You're noticing anything out of the ordinary about those dirt specks?
No, I... Saul Cohen, you for gambling?
It's a long and very strange story I'm going to tell you, Rachel Cohen. So, you might as well be comfortable.
Beneath her father's wagon, Megan McDonald feigned sleep. A few feet away, on the other side of the wagon wheels, her father, her brother, and the Reverend Milcher were having a discussion that she was most interested in hearing. Normally, she wasn't one to eavesdrop, but here she was, doing it twice in the same day. But they'd woken her, and how could she be expected to go back to sleep, especially considering the topic they'd woken her with?
Well, something's got to be done. The boy has no respect for his betters, absolutely none.
I'll agree with you there, Milcher.
He's an ass.
Oh, shut up, Matt. You got any bright ideas, Milcher? I already tried it the American way. Trade holding a meeting and a voting. What did I get for it? Sass. Plain sass, I tell you. It put me in mind of when I was a lad in Scotland. Jason Fury's putting on a bit of the English, I think.
You know I would not willingly wish harm on any man, Mr. MacDonald. It is not the Christian way, and I know that you wouldn't either.
Matt! Of course not, Reverend. I had nothing so drastic in mind. After all, he saved my darling lass sleeping there beneath the wagon from those filthy redskins and wiped that smirk off your face, Matthew.
I'll be bidding you good night then, MacDonald. I'm afraid that for now we are in the grips of an ethical dilemma that can't be settled by three men in one night. And I must get some rest. It's been a long day.
Ah, that is as, Milcher.
May God bless you both, then.
Megan knew that her father wouldn't do any serious physical harm to Jason. He just wasn't that kind. Oh, he might try to undercut him at any and every given opportunity, and he might even get mad enough to hit him. But he wouldn't kill him. She doubted the Reverend Milcher would even take a swing at him, despite all his complaints. He was too much of a coward. They just didn't like taking orders from somebody younger than they were, that was it. They were men accustomed to being in charge. Matt, though, he was different. Megan loved her brother, but she knew that at heart, he was a bully. And she thought he might just be a dangerous bully. Deadly, even. Jason had to be warned, and it looked like it was up to her to do it. Jason sat his mare on a ridge not far above the plodding wagons, watching their progress. He was glad they'd left the plains of Kansas far behind. There, one wag had said, you could look farther and see less than anywhere else in the world. Jason had to agree with him. Kansas, then the Indian Territory, and now New Mexico, beautiful and bleak at the same time. Since early in the trip and the trouble with Salmon's axle, Jason had been able to avoid stopping near any towns. He did this for two reasons. His father had tended to avoid them, saying that introducing strangers to the mix made for trouble. The second reason was some paperwork that had inexplicably floated across Jason's desk during the war, probably from somebody's attempt to effectively lose it. These papers had told of a wagon train headed west that had cut through the Utah Territory and stopped by a town. A short time after they moved on, they were attacked by what was alternately reported as a band of Indians or settlers disguised as Indians, or both. At any rate, the pilgrims were slaughtered, probably by radical Mormons, although the case had never been fully looked into due to the more pressing issues of the war with the South. That had been the Mountain Meadow Massacre. Jason wasn't taking any chances. Despite their problems with the Comanche, they were still what would be considered a rich wagon train. They had more than their share of livestock, and between the cloth and so on in Randall Nordstrom's extra wagon and the hardware in Saul Cohen's, the train would be prime booty for any plains pirates that happened along. There hadn't been any more talk of replacing him since a fortnight passed and that Comanche business, although Megan had come to him the next morning. She'd warned him to watch out for her brother, Matt, as if he needed anyone to tell him that, and she'd repeated the conversation she'd overheard between her father, her brother, and Milcher. He made note of both, although he had to admit that he took more notice of how pretty Megan looked that morning. That, at least, was real and visible, and touchable, although he hadn't. One hand had started toward her shoulder, but he'd stopped its movement. There was no future in it, was there? And he was a man intent on realities, on things that were tangible. So he hadn't touched Megan. Not a friendly hand on her shoulder, not a tender, brief brush of her cheek, nothing then, nothing since, because she didn't fit into his plan for the future. The one in which he took these people where they wanted to go, made his way back east, went to college, and then on to big, important things. But lately, he was having a harder and harder time keeping his hands off her. Hell, he couldn't stop thinking about her. He even dreamt about her, about his lips on hers, about the softness of her throat and the thin velvet skin of her eyelids. Tantalizing, disturbing dreams of his arms about her in the night, and what they would do together. He gave his head a shake, trying to rid it of such thoughts. He had no business thinking them. What he ought to be thinking about was Jenny. His little sister hadn't been the same since they'd lost their father. The sparkle was gone from her eyes. He hadn't expected it to return this soon, but he thought that he would have seen some hint, some vestige of it at odd, unguarded moments. But no, nothing. Oh, she went through the motions. She drove their wagon every day, helped make camp at night, helped with the cooking, which, fortunately, had turned into a more communal affair. But she wasn't anywhere near the same boisterous, opinionated, curious brat he'd known all of her life. He was beginning to think that perhaps she'd be better off if he just dropped her off somewhere. He knew a few people along the route, people that he'd trust to keep his only sister safe until he came for her. Of course, that had been before the war, years ago. There was no telling if any of them were still alive. It was a hard life west of the Mississippi, and the farther west you went, the tougher it got. He comforted himself that they'd be out of Comanche territory soon, but then that only meant they'd be going into Apache country. The Apache weren't that much of a threat, unless, of course, you were a Mexican, a race of people against whom the Apache seemed to hold a special grudge. The wagons would travel south of Tucson through Apache Pass, which was the heart of Chiricahua Apache territory. His father had told him plenty of stories about them, none of them too appetizing. They were in the New Mexico territory now. They had just forded Ute Creek with no problem and were in sight of the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, which at this far distance looked misty and insignificant. He figured to make Santa Fe, just past the southern end of the Sangre de Cristos, within 10 days. That is, if they kept moving as fast as they had. This was his one secret pride, that he was making better time than Jedediah ever had made when ferrying settlers over the Santa Fe Trail. Of course, outside of that incident in the panhandle of the Indian Territory, that had been a piece of really bad luck. Or good luck. Jason guessed it all depended on how you looked at it. He'd been tremendously aided by good weather and a distinct lack of Comanche, which he was beginning to think might have something to do with Quanah Parker. They had also been fortunate to find water when it was needed, when their reserve barrels were nearly dry, and had been able to find not only enough to drink and water the livestock, but to refill their barrels completely, every time. But he knew that his father would be proud of him. And for some reason he didn't entirely understand, because he and his father had spent most of their time disagreeing over nearly every conceivable subject, this gave him a great deal of pleasure. He'd put Ward temporarily in charge of leading the train. Matt and Gil could handle the livestock for a while. The animals were fat, still, and not inclined to be spooky or stampede. He watched the wagons pass him, swinging south, followed by the herd and Ramuda. He sat a moment longer, his thoughts drifting back to Megan McDonald, all red hair and freckles and Celtic charm, And then, finally, he nudged the mare with his knees, cantering to catch up with the wagons. The rain started at about 3 in the afternoon, and Jason had to choose between trying to hurry the wagons along and thus beat the rising waters to the next ford, that of another branch of the Canadian River, stopping exactly where they were in an attempt to let the waters go down again before they reached their banks. He chose the latter. Wisely, he hoped. There was no shelter of trees, the terrain being rocky and open, the substrate gravelly, with most vegetation no higher than a bush. Jason circled the wagons as best he could in the face of what had rapidly become a hard pelt of rain and brought the herd within the circle. Lightning had a tendency to spook cattle, but when they were firmly surrounded by a comforting fence, or in this case, a circle of wagons, they wouldn't be tempted to bolt. Rounding up the entire herd tomorrow, if they were hidden in every nook and cranny for 3 miles around, was the last thing he needed. He helped a few folks unhitch their draft animals, gave Olympia Morelli a hand with her wagon's canopy, untying it on one side and stretching it out overhead and mooring it by poles to make a covered porch of sorts. It had fallen upon Olympia, along with Rachel Cohen, to do most of the cooking, since they were both extraordinary cooks. Oh, the other women helped with stirring or chopping or basting things, but it was those two who kept them fed, preparing the big evening communal meal. Beneath this canvas-canopied area, Rachel and Olympia set out a large table, packs of cleavers, big wooden spoons, skillets, and cookpots, while a few feet away, out in the rain, Jenny tried to get a fire lit, but the sage she was using was green, and the rain wasn't helping matters. They'd used up the last of their buffalo chips a few days ago, but even that wouldn't have helped. When damp, they were unlightable, and nobody would want to handle them anyway. Jason was about to go to her aid when, from across the camp, Megan came out of the rain, bearing a burning torch of twigs beneath her duster, which she held over her back and head and outstretched at arm's length to shelter the flames. He watched as she and Jenny then worked the twigs beneath the pile of brush and brought it to a hissing blaze.
Baking powder. Where's baking powder?
This happened at roughly the same time that various members of the party began to arrive with chickens, one here, two there, already dressed out, and vegetables. He smiled at the sight of those chickens. Saul Cohen had said that Rachel put her foot down to the other women.
If you're cooking, Olympia and I are going to do, the least you can do is make the food ready. And by that, I mean you should clean it on the inside and outside.
From that day forward, vegetables had arrived peeled or chopped or washed. Chickens had arrived plucked and gutted, and goats, deer, and antelope had arrived skinned, gutted, and either already on the spit or cleaved into quarters. Out of respect for Rachel, Olympia requested that no hogs be slaughtered. None were. For folks that the Reverend Milcher had wanted to leave behind at the side of the road, the Cohens were turning out to be real leading citizens. Jason was thinking this just as Lavinia Milcher showed up with a pot of sliced carrots and what looked like chopped onions. She stayed on while the other women just dropped off hens or vegetables or bags of flour or cornmeal and proceeded to fix the dish herself. Jason figured it must be something her kids liked, though. God knows why. When he was a kid, it would have taken the militia to get him to eat carrots. Rather than being pressed into kitchen duty, Rachel already had Saul cutting up chickens into pieces for frying, Jason walked over to his wagon, leading his Palomino mare. Once there, he stripped her of saddle and bridle and fed her a rasher of oats and barley, topping it off with a handful of corn. While she munched her supper, he walked out through the herd and found his father's roan, Gumption, which he led back to the wagon. He filled Gumption's nose bag with the same mix he'd just fixed for Cleo. He patted her sleek golden neck.
Gonna give you the day off tomorrow, Cleo, because you're getting fat, Gumption.
Jenny was inside, hunched over a book.
Hello, Daredevil.
Daredevil?
Saw you and Megan lighting the fire earlier. Good job.
Thanks.
What you reading, Jen?
Moby Dick.
Gonna be a goose drowner.
A toad floater.
Gotta get you started on Jane Austen, Jenny.
Why?
Just think you ought to be reading some girl books, that's all.
What?
Don't holler at me. I'm sleeping. Then wake me for supper.
Ugh.
Jason fell asleep, and the sound of raindrops pelting overhead